From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, the legislature wraps up its session with a little drama. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts about the passage of teacher evaluations. And New York is expected to continue efforts to improve health care, even if the Supreme Court overturns the law. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. There was a little bit of drama in an otherwise mundane end to the legislative session when Senate Republicans agreed in the final hours to approve Governor Cuomo's proposal on how to make teacher evaluations public. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Senate Republicans on the final day of the session agreed to take up Cuomo's bill. It will make public all teacher evaluations without the names attached. Parents then would be able to obtain the specific evaluations of their own child's teacher. Assembly Democrats had previously agreed to pass it. Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelo says it's a reasonable compromise.
I think it strikes a good balance between parents' right to know and some form of confidentiality.
Some GOP senators were concerned that the bill would inadvertently result in the disclosure of the identities of teachers in small rural schools. Senate Education Chair John Flanagan calls the agreement a work in progress and says the message of intent accompanying the bill will attempt to make clear the need to protect teacher privacy.
Someone's asking me what I believe the legislative intent to be. I'm hoping that if you're in a small school and they release data by class, subject, and grade, that there's some type of interpretation to protect people's privacy.
And Senator Skelo says the bill might need to be amended later. The complexities involved in striking a balance between teacher privacy and the parents' right to know was the subject of debate on the assembly floor. Some lawmakers say it's too early to devise a means to publicly release the data, while most schools have not even finalized the criteria for conducting the evaluations. The teacher evaluations, agreed to as part of New York's federal Race to the Top grant monies, will be completed by schools within the next year. Assemblyman Joel Miller, a Republican from the Hudson Valley, says there's also no way to prevent the teacher's scores from becoming public through social media on the Internet.
When the parent gets the information that their teacher is the top teacher in the school, they'll be perfectly happy to keep that a secret. But when they get the information that their kid is going to be taught by the worst teacher in the school, I can assure you that their smoke will come out of their ears. And the pressure to start pressing the buttons on their computer to spread that information will be overwhelming.
Governor Cuomo admits they can't prevent parents from distributing the information on their child's teacher, and he says it would not be appropriate to penalize parents who do so.
The only way to really prevent that is you'd have to say, well, there's going to be a sanction for a parent, and you get this information on a confidential basis. And if you disclose it, you're going to be fined. There's a penalty. It's a misdemeanor. Your child is going to be deducted 2 grades. You know, I don't want to do any of that.
The bill is backed by the state's major teachers' unions. The New York State United Teachers, in a statement, says the measure will keep teacher personnel records confidential and stop the shameless media exploitation and distortion of evaluations. Several New York City newspapers have previously published teacher scores with the names attached. The unions have often helped both Assembly Democrats and Senate Republicans in their election campaigns through donations and staffing for phone banks and door-to-door door-to-door literature distribution. When the Senate Republicans ultimately agreed to the evaluation disclosure bill, they went against the wishes of New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg. Bloomberg had sought greater disclosure of teacher scores. Senator Skelos, who's been an ally of the mayor, admits he spoke to Bloomberg and that the mayor is disappointed.
I hope he'll see that the glass was half full rather than half empty.
But Senator Skelos predicts the two will work together on other issues in the future. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. I'm looking at a headline, Alan. We've just jumped into a studio from our Karen DeWitt. It says, ding, 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 breaking news. And it looks like we have an agreement. The Senate has agreed Thursday morning this week that they're going to go along with Cuomo's teacher evaluation bill.
Well, this is an interesting story, both from the substance and also from the politics of the situation. Let me start by telling you that Andrew Cuomo has not made many friends among the teachers' unions. In fact, wherever I go, they talk about how he has really been unfair to them, that he scapegoated them, and they're very angry with him. And I know I have some sources within the union, too, who have told me that. However, he knows that, and he's a smart guy. He's always trying to balance things. So now that he's alienated them, you know, things like the budgets in schools and not enough money to run the schools and the rest of it. Now that he's alienated them, he is trying very hard to take back some territory, which he is doing with this bill. After all, this is a very weak bill about whether parents should be allowed to know about teachers. You can go in the room, you can't write anything down, names will be redacted, as opposed to what they wanted to do in New York City. And that was, it's a public knowledge, everybody gets to know how each teacher is doing and the rest. So this is a very weak bill compared to what Mayor Bloomberg wanted in New York City. And the approach from Cuomo is to say, see, I'm sure I can just hear him, see what I did for you teachers.
Meantime, the session is wrapping up. Maybe your assessment of the session itself, how Cuomo has done. Obviously, he rides high in public opinion polls. And then these two last bits that don't seem to be getting accomplished, the reform of some of the marijuana laws as well as the minimum wage bill.
Well, it's pretty clear that in the New York State Senate, they don't like marijuana. They may have all smoked it. My bet is that they did at one point in their lives. But hypocrites being what hypocrites are, you know, they can smoke it in a safe place. A black kid or a Hispanic kid smoking it out on the street is going to be stopped, frisked, and put into the judicial system. So the idea of decriminalizing it or making it an offense like a driving offense sounds good to me, but not to them. Now, with that said, if Andrew Cuomo wanted a marijuana bill, he would bring Dean Skelos into a room and he would yell at him and he would get his way. After all, Andrew Cuomo is the only reason the Republicans are going to be in the majority, if they are, because he allowed them to reapportion themselves and he didn't veto that stupid bill, which allowed them to do that. And so they owe him everything. It was said of Mario Cuomo, the father, that if he didn't have Warren Anderson and the Republicans there, he would have had to invent them, because otherwise the state Senate under the Democrats would have gone hog wild and spent everything in sight. Clearly, the same thing is true for his son Andrew here. Andrew has really gone out of his way to protect those Republicans. So when you get a minimum wage bill and Dean Skelos says, well, we can't have a minimum wage bill in New York, and Andrew says, well, I'm for it, but not maybe this year, or I can't get a deal, the Republicans won't deal. That's the same old, well, what's the psychological academic word, crap, that has always gone on under the name of politics. Meantime, the people haven't taken a look at that. You know, they think that he's gotten things done. Well, what they really mean is he wasn't David Paterson and he wasn't Elliot Spitzer with his, you know, unfortunate political demise. I still think that was one of the great tragedies of all times, because Spitzer's simply one of the brightest men I have ever known. So they said, OK, finally, we got a little stability, you know, in the office. But don't tell me a lot of things have gotten done, because they haven't.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York State Senate has voted to cap property tax assessments on farmlands. We get that story from the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley.
In a unanimous bipartisan vote, the New York State Senate passed legislation that will cap agricultural assessments at 2% from the previous year. The New York Farm Bureau says many farmers have seen large increases in their property tax bills this year, and by next year, it's estimated that assessed land values will nearly double per acre from 5 years ago. New York Farm Bureau spokesman Steve Ammerman says for farmers to stay in business, they need a lower assessment on their agricultural lands.
The ag assessment process is a very complicated formula. It takes everything in from soil type to ag income over a period of years, but also the state formula uses national data. And one of the things that's driving up national numbers are the farmers out in the Midwest, many of them producing corn that's going into ethanol. That's driving up our state formula. And another reason that we're seeing higher assessments, there's also high development areas in New York State. You know, you're talking about Saratoga, Hudson Valley, the Finger Lakes, Westchester County, where you're seeing more of a buildup, and it's also driving up overall land assessments for everybody, but it's also hitting us farmers especially hard.
Essex County Farm Bureau President Eric Lurkey says farmers in certain areas of the state may need the cap more than other areas, but he feels more than a cap is needed to help agriculture.
New York has an average property tax of $26 per acre, where nationally, this is for ag land, nationally that's $6 an acre average. So we're $20 an acre higher in New York. So farmers definitely need some relief from those increasing taxes. There's been a lot of measures. You know, we have the 2% tax cap, but we need mandate relief, I think, more than anything to help all the local municipalities. The state tells them they have to do these things, but they don't get any help with it. It's tough for the towns, and that gets passed down.
The Farm Bureau's Steve Ammerman says the tax cap would only be a stopgap because it does not address the problem of rising assessments.
Overall, the formula needs to change in how ag assessments are derived. What the Farm Bureau is advocating for is a more thorough discussion with the governor, with ag experts, people from Cornell, with farmers, with all of us sitting down at the table and looking for a long-term solution to essentially reform the formula. In our latest figures from Farm Credit, property taxes are nearly 25% of a farmer's net income. That's pretty substantial.
As New York State works on agricultural property taxes, the U.S. Senate agreed to move forward this week with the federal farm bill. Northeast Dairy Farmers Cooperative Senior Dairy Policy Advisor Bob Gray feels the dairy title in the legislation will be very good for Northeast farmers.
Because it has a provision for dairy producers to buy insurance. At first, I had some questions about it, but we've ran some numbers on it and with different scenarios of farm milk prices, and it seems to me it's a pretty good deal. And if I was a farmer or advising a farmer on this, if this becomes law, I'd advise him to get the insurance and to get the supplemental. The amendments that were dealt with yesterday included one with Senator Snow, which attracted the most attention. Senator Snow of Maine wants to move the ball down the field on federal milk marketing order reform. Another amendment by Senator Collins of Maine was very similar, but she withdrew that amendment once Senator Snow's amendment was approved.
Gray expects final passage of the farm bill in the Senate today, with movement then into the House. The property tax cap voted on by the New York State Senate has not been acted on in the New York State Assembly.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
New York State is expected to press on with efforts to increase and improve health care coverage should the U.S. Supreme Court overturn all or part of the landmark 2010 Affordable Care Act. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
Regardless of the court decision, it is expected New York will move forward to expand health coverage to the 2.8 million state residents who are without it. The Supreme Court is expected to release a decision any day now, and groups like Citizen Action are very concerned, ready to launch reactionary speakouts. Bob Cohen is policy director with Citizen Action New York.
We're talking about a law that, for example, is allowing tens of thousands of New Yorkers under 26 to be eligible, being covered when they, for example, don't have jobs after college, Millions of New Yorkers have benefited from the prohibition on lifetime limits and insurance policies. Small businesses are eligible for business tax credits to provide employees with health insurance. And we think that the Supreme Court, if they strike down significant provisions of the act, it really will be a disaster for healthcare consumers.
New York State Medicaid Director Jason Helgerson told Gannett News the state is proud of its safety net, which he pronounced as one of the most extensive in the nation. Kenneth Raske, president and CEO of the Greater New York Hospital Association, suggests New York turn toward Massachusetts and its so-called RomneyCare plan as a model.
I think New York has been outstanding in terms of providing coverage to vulnerable populations historically, whether they're adults or children. It has really led the nation, quite honestly, in that capacity. Under Governor Cuomo, he has done an outstanding job in coming to terms with the cost and efficiency issue simultaneous with the expansion of coverage. The sense that I have is that we're about as well positioned as a state as anybody. Notwithstanding those remarks, though, we will still have to take a hard look at trying to make sure anybody that doesn't have insurance has at least a shot at some degree of coverage. And that's what I'm talking about as we look to Massachusetts and the expansion that they had a few years ago, which has the nickname RomneyCare.
New York is one of a handful of states engaged in the process of creating state-based exchanges, where, beginning in 2014, uninsured individuals and businesses will be able to purchase affordable insurance coverage. The Supreme Court justices could decide to leave the entire law intact. They could rule the entire law unconstitutional. They could conclude that making everyone buy health insurance is unconstitutional, but let the rest of the law stand. Or they could determine that the provision expanding Medicaid is unconstitutional and the rest of the law is fine. Hospitals and congressional Democrats who voted for the Affordable Care Act have fingers crossed that the Supreme Court will leave it intact.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Each year, more than 1,000 refugees are sent to Buffalo. They're helping to repopulate the shrinking Rust Belt city after a half century of decline. Most refugees are illiterate in their native languages, yet are expected to learn English upon arrival. As the Innovation Trail's Daniel Robison reports, literacy is seen as the refugee's best chance to become successful in America.
Abdi Hussein sits in a cramped classroom full of old metal chairs that clank and scrape the faded tile floor.
No dictionary. No dictionary.
Here, they learn idioms like don't judge a book by its cover and how to order adjectives.
But you're just going to make a nice, simple sentence, okay? English is a blank, blank, blank language, right?
This is a long way from Somalia, where Hussein struggled to find food and lived in constant fear of being dragged into the country's ongoing civil war.
It's kind of horrible things, people kill each other. So that's why we get help to get in here. People call us a refugee.
Now, Hussein lives in a growing Somali community in a poor area of Buffalo. Aging, inexpensive housing has proven fertile ground for ethnic neighborhoods made up largely of refugees. While at home and around friends, Hussein says he's tempted to speak his native Somali language, but he was told learning English will help him find a job in America.
English is not my language. It's kind of difficult to speak and to read and to understand the words, but I study hard.
During class, Hussein is clustered in a room with 24 other refugees from Ghana, Iraq, Burma, and Afghanistan. Most refugees are enrolled within 72 hours of arrival. Each student knows a different language or dialect. Teacher Nick Prin instructs his class to speak as a group. He says it's the best way to make the most progress with the most students.
You got to speak first, and then the reading and the writing is a secondary concern. It kind of hurts to put them on the back burner, but If you think about if you go to another country, the first thing you need to do is speak.
For most refugees, classrooms are an entirely new concept. Many have never used electricity, a phone, or a pencil before. They start at the very beginning, learning by tracing the alphabet. Anne Britton is with Catholic Charities of Buffalo, which offers 10 levels of English classes.
You know, we're not looking for people to quote Shakespeare. We're looking for people to know what the difference is between hot and cold and slow down, go faster. I mean, very basic life skills and employment skills that they need.
But at a certain point, refugees would rather spend time looking for work or earning an income than sitting in class. So says Amy Lawrence of Literacy Volunteers of Buffalo. Refugees are responsible for paying for their plane tickets to the U.S., so most are immediately in debt. And Lawrence says English classes don't pay the bills.
They want the jobs now. They want the skills now. They don't want to wait a couple years, you know, and many of them have families they have to start providing right now.
In essence, that's what local leaders want from refugees, to help the local economy by getting jobs and building a new tax base. Most settle for work in restaurants and hotels that don't require fluency in English. Government officials say refugees are also in high demand at local companies. But with Buffalo's cheap rent and low cost of living, some opt to start their own businesses. Louis Sano plays a carimba, a popular instrument she sells in her shop, Global Villages. She has colorful baskets, handmade jewelry, and painted ostrich eggs as big as footballs.
Right now, I have products from Rwanda, which is my native country, and then South Africa, Swaziland, Zimbabwe, and I have products from Kenya.
Sano came to Buffalo in 2007 as a refugee. She received business training from a local nonprofit and eventually a microloan. Her shop started as just a table among many and a flea market-like store for small refugee businesses.
The community show us, you know what, yes, you are a refugee, but that is a status. It's not like a state of mind. It's not like you cannot think or you cannot do this. You can't. So if you are told you can, you can.
Now, with a growing customer base, Sano is expanding into a larger space. She plans to hire fellow refugees to work in the store, which she hopes will help them learn English. She's also eager to help them write business plans and eventually open their own shops here in Buffalo.
That was the Innovation Trail's Daniel Robison reporting. Support for the Innovation Trail comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Innovation Trail is a collaboration between five upstate public media outlets reporting about New York's innovation economy. You can hear more at innovationtrail.org. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of the program are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number again, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1225. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.